Welcome to OWW Radio. I am your host, Alex Goff, and this week I am joined by a very special guest, Brian Alvarez from WrestlingObserver.com, F4WOnline.com, and this week we'll be discussing the new book that he's a co-author on, The Death of WCW, which is coming out in a variety of forms, hardcover, softcover, and on the Kindle. This is a re-release of a book that was written, when did the original come out, Brian?
2005, I believe.
2005. And so we have Brian Alvarez. And there's a thousand things I want to talk to Brian about. I've always wanted to interview Brian Alvarez. So first of all, thank you very much for joining me, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So The Death of WCW. Now, the past few years, you've kind of taken a step back from writing as much of your weekly newsletter. And so how was it to go back and review your writings in this book and then to write new material?
Well, when I wrote it the first time, when it was done, I vowed I would never write a book again because it took years off my life. But we had been talking about it, Artie and I, doing an anniversary edition. And obviously today there's significantly more wrestling books. I got a wrestling book. It was about the history of the NWA. And this book was like, it seemed like it was about 5,000 pages long. And I was like, how did they get like 5,000 pages? And our word count was stuck at 120,000 words. It just seems weird. But it turns out there's just far more books, and ECW Press discovered that, hey, these books sell. So we were given the opportunity to re-release it and put in a bunch of stuff that we cut. And obviously, since it's a 10-year anniversary edition of the publication of the book, there was a lot of stuff. There are a lot of guys that, you know, when we wrote the book, they'd gone from WCW to WWF, WWE. And they weren't allowed to talk. And today, there's a lot of guys that are out of the business. They don't care anymore. They got plenty of stories. They got plenty of stuff to talk about. So we were able to put a bunch of stuff back in, add a bunch of stuff. I've got a new chapter on the legacy of WCW and TNA, which is quite a chapter if you've followed TNA. To see the capsule history of TNA in one chapter is pretty mind-numbing, actually. So it was fun to put together. It was very hard. It wasn't as hard as the first time, but I did write a lot of stuff. I mean, I totally rewrote the first chapter, the pre-1995 history chapter. I added, I don't even know how many words to the year 2000 chapter, which is just the... You'll read that chapter, and it's difficult to decide whether TNA or WCW is the more inept wrestling company. It's pretty bad. And then there's a TNA chapter. So there's a whole bunch of new stuff. Dave Meltzer wrote a new foreword. It's almost 500 pages long, and it's really great. So everyone head up to WrestlingObserver.com, click on the Death of WCW link, and buy it. I really appreciate it.
Writing the first book, rewrite, and then adding new content to the second book. I mean, in short, what are your overall thoughts on WCW? I mean, this was the most successful wrestling promotion ever, and also, is it still the highest grossing? Do they have the highest grossing year ever in professional wrestling?
Oh no, WWE's destroyed them.
Okay.
Yeah. The story of the book is just that. I don't want to say it's not that hard, because if it were not that hard, there'd be a lot of other successful wrestling companies. But WCW was a promotion that they made it very hard for themselves. And they did a lot of really stupid things. And at the end of the day, it's not hard to look at what is successful and look at what is not successful and make decisions for the future. If something is clearly not working, and this is, you can listen to this as a history of WCW or as a cautionary tale about TNA today. If something is not working, stop doing it. If something is working, continue doing it. You can experiment. You can try new things, but you're going to find out pretty quickly if the new things are what your audience wants or if the new things are what your audience does not want. And WCW and TNA today, WCW was filled with people who had an idea of what they wanted to do. It didn't matter what anybody else said. It didn't matter what any numbers or anything. No evidence to the contrary could prevent them from doing the stupid things that they did. And it got worse and worse and worse. And then it died.
How much would you say also you need to have a good vision or a good visionary in front of the company? And I say that to say this, is that I was listening to an interview with Bill Simmons, who provides a range of content for ESPN, a podcast, documentaries, and he had started a podcast in 2007. And he had said during the interview about what a bold step that was, how small the podcast genre was in 2007. You had started a podcast in 2005, and not only did you start a podcast, but you created a pay site to access the podcast. Just thinking back on my own personal experience, I actually set up my PayPal account to be able to access your website. And buying and selling stuff on the internet, I don't think was nearly what it is today. So as far as being able to see the future, I mean, as far as it relates to WCW First, how important is that in running a wrestling company? Is it just making the right decisions, or do you need to have someone who can see the future? And then secondly, I'll ask you about yourself. And so first about WCW, how important was it that they were able to see things before they came?
Well, I think you've got to have, you should have somebody there that is in charge. You know, that was one of the problems near the end in WCW. Nobody knew who was in charge. Nobody could get an answer from anybody. And really, if you, excuse me, if you read the book, that's only that's a small part of the overall problem. I mean, there were a million problems, but certainly a big one was that there was no Vince McMahon in a lot of ways. There was no great wrestling mind, and there was not even like a secondary wrestling mind, a lesser wrestling mind, that at least everybody knew this was the guy in charge. And that person would steer the ship. If the ship was heading towards the iceberg, you can replace that guy, come up with somebody else. It was just like a whole bunch of different people. Everybody wanted to cast the blame on everybody else. And it's very hard to have a direction and to run a company when you have the proverbial too many cooks in the kitchen. You've got to have that main guy. And again, this is not the reason, this is not the sole reason WCW went down, but it was a big reason. I mean, there are plenty of companies that have teams. And the teams work together, and they try to get a vision and get everybody on the same page and work towards that vision. WCW didn't have that either. They had nothing.
And so with yourself, 2005, you introduced this pay site, f4wonline.com. You had access to your newsletters, which you had written before the website, and also you had downloadable podcasts. Podcasts weren't really a big thing in 2005, so what inspired you to create this website?
Well, I was doing, I mean, we had Wrestling Observer Live on the radio, which I really enjoyed doing, and we had the Figure Four newsletter, and I thought, listen, the website started because the print newsletter was dying, is what happened, because at the time, I mean, everyone was starting to be able to get wrestling news online, and you could get it quickly, and you didn't have to wait for your newsletter to arrive in the mail, and often some people would get it first, and they would put all of the newsletter information on the on the internet anyway. And so it was struggling. And so I was trying to find a way to keep it in business. So I had the idea of we will say, if you're a subscriber and you would like to pay us a discounted rate, we will email the newsletter to you every week. And you won't have to wait to get it in the mail. You'll get it first, and you'll save some money. That was my idea. And at the time, mailing lists also were very different than they are today. It was difficult to set it up. They would bounce back. People wouldn't get them. They would be marked as spam. So it was a struggle. And my brother-in-law just said, you know, it'd be a lot easier if you just started a website and had a members-only area. I think that my brother-in-law, I don't think he would deny this, he was a aficionado of other members only websites on the internet, and so I think that's where he got the idea for this deal. So I was like, sure, if you can set it up, let's try it. And so he set it up, and immediately people started subscribing. And so I was like, huh, how about that? And so then the idea kind of was, you know, that you could put up some audio. So it wasn't like I was reading about the latest technological breakthroughs on the internet and thought I'm going to start a podcast. We had done, you got to go back years. I mean, even before IATA, There was the Wrestling Observer hotline. I'd had a Figure Four hotline, which started out as just like a local number that went to a voicemail with a message with all the news. And then later there were the 900 lines. So there were these wrestling hotlines, which were very popular. So our idea was, if you subscribe, you're not only going to get the newsletter, but every now and then you're going to get like a hotline. And I never called it a hotline or a podcast. I called them the radio shows, because at the end of the day, I had a radio show and I was a radio host, and I felt that I was just putting my radio shows on the internet, even though this was not technically radio. So we did these little radio shows, and it turned out that they were exceedingly popular. Like, people were talking more about the radio shows than they were about the newsletter. So then it just kind of grew from there. I slowly started putting together a studio. I listened. I was a huge fan of Art Bell, and he had a home studio, and I was always trying to build something similar. And that's really how the whole thing... I mean, Tony said we should put it on iTunes. I was like, sure, whatever that is, go for it. And so it ended up on iTunes. And, you know, I could sit here and take credit and say that I was like a podcast visionary. But really, it was just we did an updated version of an old school wrestling hotline. Tony put it on iTunes and it became a popular podcast. That's really how the whole thing happened.
Well, you make the story sound very simplistic, and I'm sure it broke out that way to you. I mean, was there any trepidation, like maybe we're going too fast? Maybe were you afraid maybe people wouldn't be interested in this new genre? Because, like I said, specifically the paywall. While Tony was familiar with sites that required you to pay, that genre had been established, I think, a lot longer than. I'm paying for a podcast. While podcast, because at the time, podcasting wasn't really a thing yet. And so at any point, did you have any questions like maybe this isn't going to work, or is this, we'll see?
No, because the point you're missing is that the print newsletter was doing very badly. You know what I mean? Like, as soon as it was not like, it wasn't like with the print newsletter, I was making, you know, $10,000 a month and all this money was rolling in. And so I decided to start this website, and it was kind of like, I hope this website can generate a little bit of comparable amount of money. It was more like, this newsletter, you know, I've got a second job here. I'm trying to pay for my $800 a month apartment. You know, I was not making any money. It was a situation where everything was changing really, really quickly. The newsletter was very popular for a long time, but the internet changed everything. I mean, it was the same thing that happened with the music industry. It was the same thing that happened with all sorts of different genres that relied on a physical thing, and all of a sudden you can get that thing digitally. And so it was kind of like, oh, geez, this print newsletter is just, it's not working. The future is not a print newsletter. I've got to figure something out. And so when I started the website, it began generating money immediately. But it wasn't like a lot of money, but even that small amount of money was like, okay, good. We're doing okay now. That's all I needed. And it wasn't like I was trying to, it wasn't like I had bills where, man, if this paywall doesn't generate, you know, $5,000 a month, I'm going to sink. It was kind of like, if this paywall generates a little bit of money, we're all right. I wasn't trying to get rich. I was trying to pay some bills. So, you know, it grew a lot from there. But at the very beginning, it wasn't about making a lot of money. It was making a little money, and it was making a little money, and so I kept going with it.
How do you look at other entrepreneurs who are struggling with some of the same things you were struggling with in 2005, where their old business model is no longer generating the same profits, and they're having to experience the same thing where they're looking to how we're going to monetize this product?
Well, I mean, our site's doing very well. And I mean, you know, if you go on our board, I mean, yes, I realize that there is a million things that we could do better with this website. But this is not Apple or Microsoft. It's me and Dave and Tony, and Josh Nason helps a lot. Josh Nason is an unheralded hero. And there's some others that help out as well. But really, it's a small operation. And we are attempting to tackle things as they come along. But it's not easy. It's not, I mean, the one thing that I've learned, and it took a little while, but I eventually figured this out, is you cannot make everybody happy. You can't. It's impossible. And if you fixate on this idea of trying to make everybody happy, you are guaranteed to fail. So all you can do is, I hate to use this term, because they use it on Raw all the time. You've got to do what is best for business. And unfortunately, when you do what is best for business, there's always a subset of people who usually are the loudest, who get very mad and they complain and they cry about how the sky is falling. But at the end of the day, I can see all the numbers. I can see what people read. I can see when people subscribe. And there are things that we could do better. There's a lot of them. And slowly we are trying to make things better. But there's no easy road to anything. And luckily, podcasts right now are very popular. So I'm not overly concerned about the near-term future. Now, down the road, I don't know. You know, we've experimented with a lot of different things. I mean, we did the live show experiment, which is still going, but I've pulled back on it. Because at the end of the day, and I said this before we even went live. At the end of the day, we are an on-demand society right now. And people want to listen to what they want to listen to when they want to listen to it. And so live is fun, especially if you're a radio show, because you can get instant feedback. But it's not a make or break. And we have been just as successful with non-live programming. So instead of having every show live, for example, which we did for about 6 months, now it's certain shows are going to be live. Many shows are not going to be live. And the live shows hopefully will be a little bit more special because they're infrequent. But it's all experimenting, seeing what works. Is it a positive or a negative for the big picture? What can we slowly try to fix and make better and work at? But there's no simple answer to any of this. And a lot of it with any business has been luck. I mean, we were lucky because we got in on the ground floor. We were doing podcasts in 2005. And so we were in early. And whenever you're in early, you've got a big advantage. You know, Dave obviously has been doing The Observer since 1983. So obviously we've got a gigantic advantage by having Dave on the docket here. I mean, there's a lot of things where we're lucky because we were first. But at the end of the day, you can't rely on that, and you've got to just look around at what other people are doing successfully, look around at what maybe isn't working. I read all feedback, positive and negative, and sometimes, you know, sometimes negative feedback is just, it's a bunch of people saying a bunch of stupid stuff. And they don't understand the big picture. And sometimes the negative feedback is like, you know, this guy's right. So what can we do to fix this? It's not going to be fixed tomorrow. But what can we do to slowly try to make things better? And that's all you can do. Every day you try and make things a little bit better. But it doesn't happen overnight. And it's a lot of hard work. And it's not easy. And you've got to be lucky along the way.
How do you handle feedback from people inside the professional wrestling business, whether it be about something you wrote about them in particular or something about the company that they wrestle for?
I don't really get a lot. I mean, usually I mean, a lot of people listen to it and they enjoy it. Usually the only complaints are complaints where something we said was factually incorrect. I'm very critical of a lot of companies, especially like Impact, for example. But at the end of the day, I try not to be unfair in my criticism. I don't think that I'm unfair when I say a show sucks, if it sucks. I mean, you know, sometimes there are a lot of critics of any genre where when you listen to them, it's like, okay, now we're just complaining for the sake of complaining. And I try never to complain for the sake of complaining. Sometimes I'll harp on something, but if I harp on something, it's something I really believe. I'm not going to make up a criticism. Like if you know, I'm not going to start to, I think Seth Rollins is awesome, but I'm not going to sit here and start criticizing Seth Rollins and making things up, because I think that complaining about something or burying something is what people want to hear. There's enough stupid stuff in pro wrestling that I will always have something to complain about and to rant about. But I think that when you do a podcast, I mean, it's very important that you try to be as honest as you can. If you don't like something, say that it sucks. If you think something is great, say that you think it is great. Do your best to always give. And something that people understand is you can change your mind. You know, sometimes there's something that I watch it and I think it absolutely sucks. And you watch it for 4 or 5 weeks and you realize, you know, this is really growing on me. And it's okay for your opinion to change. I think that it's important to be honest with your feelings. And yes, sometimes things suck. But again, I don't think I'm unfair about it. And so I very rarely hear from people that go, man, I can't believe you buried that Impact show. I mean, I realize the rating collapsed throughout the show, but hey, that was a good show. You were unfair. Never happens. Because usually, I'm a pretty good, if the show's bad, I'll say it's bad. And if it's good, I'll say it's good. So I don't really get a lot of criticism based on what I say.
Now to some current mixed martial arts and professional wrestling topics. Yesterday, the biggest story that broke was the Chael Sonnen. What was the proper way to phrase it? He failed a out of competition test.
That's what happened. Yep.
Okay. So what is kind of your sense on this? Because while Chael has always been a good speaker, he makes points that sound very good, but to you, your gut, what's your gut telling you on this story?
Chael failed for drugs that you would take to attempt to kickstart your testosterone production after you come off TRT. They are illegal in competition, and so he screwed up. Now, there is the argument that because the State Athletic Commission had approved the usage of testosterone replacement therapy, then when they banned it, they should have allowed the guys time to get their systems back to normal, as opposed to telling them to get off TRT, and then when they did what a normal doctor would prescribe them, they bust them for a failed drug test. You could make that argument. The problem, to me, is this. If the commission bans TRT in mid to late February, you should not be attempting to fight in May. If you know that in order to come off TRT, you are going to have to take these drugs. So I understand that he was booked for the fight by UFC. But there's plenty of guys that say, I can't fight because I've got this injury. I can't fight because my hand is broken. I can't fight because I've got a strained calf. This happens every single day. So what Chael and everybody else who has to come off TRT should have said is, all right, I'm going to take at least 6 to 8 months off to get my levels back to normal naturally, and then I will begin preparing for a fight. And then if after making this very clear, the commission comes to them at their house and tests them and busts them, then you can say that, you know, this was not fair by the commission. This guy is not preparing for a fight. This guy has made it very clear that he's attempting to restart his system, so he should not have been tested out of competition. But you know what? Everybody knew that Chael was on this season of Ultimate Fighter and that he was going to fight around May. And so the commission had every right to go test this guy. There's so many problems with this story, but at the end of the day, Chael should not have been preparing for a fight during a 3-month window where he also knew he was going to have to take drugs to try to get his testosterone levels back to normal because he was taking a prohibited substance. That's where this whole problem lies.
UFC is presenting a show this Saturday night that, I mean, truthfully, This is a main event that I can honestly say I have little interest in. While I find Demetrius Johnson to be an exciting fighter, I'm a big fan of his style. His opponent provides no interest to me. The rest of the card isn't really super interesting. What are your thoughts on UFC now this year looks to be one of the lowest years since the boom period that they would have they will do on pay-per-view annually. So what are your thoughts on, for example, this Saturday's show with a lack of maybe interesting fights?
Well, they've just they're doing it differently than I would do it. That's just kind of it. I mean, there's a model where the idea is you try to create superstars, and then you pit the superstars against each other, and you make people pay. This is the pro wrestling model, and this is what they did from about 2005 to 2008 or so. One pay-per-view a month, you try to get guys over, you try to make stars, you book the biggest stars against each other, etc. That's kind of the pro wrestling model that they built the company on. Now, they are the Major League Soccer model, where you've got a lot of games, and the viewership is very low, but the demographics are not bad. In fact, the demographics are good. And they're making millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars in television rights fees. And it's just two different business models. The former model is built on creating shows where everybody watches all the shows. So you see the new stars getting developed, and that's how you create them. This model is based on, it's like I'm not a big sports fan, but your average Sunday afternoon, during football season, you know, my buddy Vinny will go to a bar where there's like eight televisions playing, and he'll watch like eight different games all at the same time, which to me is like complete insanity. But some people do that. But the reality is most people, I mean, very few people, I doubt even Vinny, someone who does this for a living, everybody doesn't watch every single game. It's impossible. And that is where UFC is going. And at the end of the day, it's all about their business, because they are a business, and they are a company that is attempting to grow worldwide sport and be very, very lucrative. If at the end of the day, doing it this way, where you just run as many shows as possible and you get as many shows as you can on television all over the world, and you just collect all of these rights fees, which continue to escalate, then great. Good for them. You know, it's not the model that is going to generate mainstream fans of the sport that are rabid fans, but it is a model that's going to make you a lot of money, and it's going to grow kind of all over the world. It's kind of like, it's a difference between a very successful, hot American product and a less successful worldwide product. Less successful in the sense that you're not going to watch every single show. You may. But when we start getting these two show a day days, which we've gotten, and there are going to be more coming up, I mean, very, very few people are going to watch 12 straight hours of UFC. Even Dave Meltzer isn't going to watch 12 straight hours of UFC. So in a sense, you can say it will become less popular. Less people will be watching the shows. The ratings will go down. The attendance will probably start to creep down. But at the end of the day, they're going to be making all of this money off their rights fees. So to them, I mean, it's just like I said, it's a different model. And if it's successful, great. If it starts to slowly erode the finances of UFC, then they'll have to strongly reconsider. But, you know, they right now, it doesn't appear to be. I mean, we can look at it like pay-per-views are down and ratings are down, but are our overall revenues over the next 5-7 years going to collapse? Of course not. They're going to stay steady. And at the end of this television deal in 2017, who knows? They may get triple the rights fees. They'll be doing even better. So it's just a different way of doing business.
WWE has, with the WWE Network, seems to be taking their company into a new direction as well. You spoke earlier about an on-demand society. People like access to material on demand. Do you believe in 5 to 7 years that the WWE Network will be the future, I guess, of how everyone will be presenting their material, their content, as far as on-demand access to a library and to updated content?
I mean, who do you mean by everybody?
I mean, to me, when I look at it, I mean, it seems like in 5 to 7 years, we're going to see the major sports leagues, the NBA, NFL, want to roll out a very similar package to this. Because if you can get money on the TV rights end, and then also you can get money on the back end where people will have access to different different games that maybe are not in their market or whatever, on top of historical material, that it seems like it would be a direction that they'd want to go in. And content providers such as HBO, Showtime, that have which HBO has an HBO Go service, but just access to newer material and a library. I mean, is that kind of the direction that most people are going to go, in your estimation?
I don't know. I mean, the problem is the WWE Network is not blowing people away right now in terms of the number of... I love the WWE Network, but it to me, it's very incomplete. And you know, if this wasn't my job, I would get it strictly for the pay-per-views. You know, I was buying every pay-per-view anyway. So really... I mean, in the case of a person like me, they have slashed their revenues. That's all they've done by creating this network. And if I were not somebody that was really interested in modern day WWE, I mean, I would not resubscribe to this network in 6 months probably, because as a fan of history, it's so ridiculously incomplete. You know, I don't like having to wait for the Raws and the Nitros and the Thunders. You know, it's cool, some of the new programming they've got. I do love NXT, I will say that. I probably would buy the network for NXT, but again, I'm a fan who wants modern wrestling. And I don't know how it is. I don't know how it is for your average sports fan. I mean, wrestling is different in the sense that there are storylines. There are storylines, big personalities, matches, that sort of deal. I mean, there are storylines in sports as well, but it's not necessarily like a storyline-driven industries where, I mean, maybe this is the case. I don't know. But is your average football fan who is bombarded with football during football season, do they really need something where they can go back and watch a game from 1984, a random game or a season? I mean, are they really going to do that? I don't know. Maybe they will. But when I look at WWE's business right now, and I think about, let's see, they could have tripled their television rights fees, which wasn't going to happen, by the way. But let's just say that it did. They could make triple the money off their television rights fees, or they could make roughly the same and have this network, which like 500,000 people are subscribed to. I mean, to me, I would go for tripling my rights fees. So for your average sports league that is making ridiculous money off television rights fees, I don't see a reason for them to start up a network which may help, which may hurt them in television negotiations. The UFC Fight Pass is doing great for them, but they're doing it in a different way than WWE. They've done it completely backwards from WWE. The pay-per-views go up there eventually, but in general, if you want to see the modern stuff, you've got to watch it on television, or you've got to buy it on pay-per-view. And if you want the historical stuff, you can sign up and everything is there. So really, they've added their own WWE network, and it's like it's pure profit for them. It hasn't hurt their pay-per-view numbers. It hasn't hurt their television numbers, and it's a strong source of added income. So I think that you may see leagues doing it more like UFC is doing it, and less like WWE is doing it. And unfortunately, I think WWE just got too aggressive and they jumped in too hard, and UFC taking a much more conservative tact have done very, very well. So, you know, 5 years down the road, I don't know where either network will be. But certainly if I were a sports league right now, I'd do it way more like UFC than WWE.
Well, thank you very much for joining me this week, Brian. If people are interested in having more insight and opinions from Brian Alvarez, where can they go to get that?
No jiu-jitsu talk?
Well, did you want to talk about Worlds?
I haven't really followed it, but I thought for sure you'd be wanting to ask about some jiu-jitsu.
Well, is there a specific topic you would like
to discuss? How is your training going, Alex?
So I'm going to
hijack this interview like Conan.
Well, currently I train 4 to 5 times a week at a gym, and one gym I train at in Reno once a week, and then 4 times a week I train in the city where I live. And things are going very, very well. I think the next tournament I'm going to do is the American Nationals, which is presented by the IBJFF. I would like to move on and start doing IBJFF tournaments. And for a jiu-jitsu gym, we weren't affiliated with it. Like, you're affiliated with Pedro Sauer, so there's a lot of benefits that you get, not only in the mentorship and the business side of it, but also you have access to, your guys have access to IBJFF tournaments, because it is a recognized affiliation program, and your competitors from your gym can go there. As to where my gym, we weren't affiliated with a system or a black belt, so it was very difficult for us to get into the IBJFF tournaments. And then, so finally, my instructor and I sat down and we figured out how to do it. And then we've started a partnership with a black belt who actually just affiliated with ATOS, which is Andre Galval's affiliation program. Andre Galval, he got silver this year, Worlds, in his weight class, and widely regarded as one of the best jiu-jitsu guys in the world. And so the things that that's going to bring is going to be very interesting. But, you know, it's one of those things where I really, really, really enjoy it. I, you know, I have a question for you. So you are very famous for not being into sports and a lot of outside things. Is it because you find that you get very involved? Is that why you kind of keep yourself out of a lot of stuff?
A lot of stuff.
Yeah.
A lot of stuff. It's just not sports. You know what it is? I don't like watching sports. I would rather be doing them. And the sports that I like to do, I don't like team sports. I like individual sports. And when I was a kid and I first started watching wrestling, all I wanted to do was wrestling. I didn't want to watch baseball. I didn't want to go out for the baseball team. I didn't want to play football or watch football. All I wanted to do was wrestle. I didn't even want to just watch it. I wanted to do it. And so from the age of 14 on, all I have done is wrestle in some form, I did amateur wrestling in junior high, and then I did pro wrestling forever, and then I did jiu-jitsu. So I've been grappling with dudes and ladies nonstop since I was like 14 years old, and I do it every chance that I can get, and I don't like wasting my time. Like, I don't get why you would want to sit and just watch a football game, like watch other people do stuff. I just don't get that. I'd rather get out there and I'd rather do. I grapple every single night with my class. Like, you know, when I was coming up in training, my instructor didn't grapple every night. You know, he'd grapple here and there, but usually he'd teach the moves and he'd go, all right, let's partner up, get a partner. And he'd sit there and he'd watch. And every now and then he'd grapple somebody. Not me. I grapple every single night the entire time. And it's funny because I injured my wrist. I got tendonitis or something there. And so for like 2 weeks, I didn't grapple. Because it was from gripping. It was from grabbing the gi. And so the idea was you got to just like stop for a while. And so for 2 weeks, I didn't grapple. I just sat there and I watched the class grapple. And I got more and more pissed off like with each passing day. And I like snap at people and I just get angry. And it was right back to that sports thing. I don't want to sit there and watch you guys do this. I want to be in there doing it. And so after 2 weeks, it was kind of like, I ain't doing this anymore. I can't, you know, I'm going to get in there. And so I got in there and I grappled. And it was funny because when I'm not in there grappling, like the class, I don't want to say they fall apart, but it's like everything kind of slows down and some people are sitting out and now some people are talking and I got to get there on the mat and I got to go to get everybody else going. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And that's what I love to do. I don't like watching it. I don't like sitting there. I don't like being a spectator. I want to be there doing it and not part of a team where somebody else may be doing all the work and I'm just standing on the outfield with a glove on my hand. It sucks. I want to be right in the mix going. And so I think that's why I don't watch a lot of sports. I'm just sweating right now ranting.
For me, I'm either I'm either one or I'm 100. So it's either I'm into it or I'm not. So when I first, I'd always, my first goal, even when I, even a few years ago, I just wanted to compete in a tournament. And I remember texting Michael Coughlin, who I knew had done some tournaments at the time, and, you know, how to get started and what to do and yada, yada. And then when I got out of the military, I finally had a schedule to where I could fit it in. So I started grappling, and then I've become, you know, I watch jiu-jitsu all the time. I keep up to date on the most current competitors. And I've had to push a few other things, mostly sports, kind of more and more out of my life because I don't have time, and it's either I'm in or I'm out. And so I keep up on a conversation level. Like, I'm confident I'm able to converse with someone about the news stories of the day, for example, but I'm not as familiar with the statistics and all the things that I used to follow closely. And for me currently, I mean, I train regularly, and my goal is to eventually be a black belt. But while I guess I'm a younger man, I turned 30 this year. Your birthday's tomorrow. Happy early birthday, Brian. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I want to do this competition thing while I can. I believe that it provides a lot for the experience overall, for what I'm able to tell. I remember when I lived in San Diego, I took a couple classes at a local gym, and Dean Lister was the coach. And Dean Lister would say, the instructor would say, oh, here's how you do a Dars, for example. And then Lister would come behind him and say, well, you know, when I was in ADCC, I did this little variation, and it worked real well. And I was always really impressed by that. So I think there is a benefit to competing. And I'd rather do it while I'm young than while I'm older. And I don't train every day. So many jiu-jitsu guys say that. You've said that. I train every day. I don't train every day. I train 4 to 5 times a week every week. And I love going to other gyms. I was in Florida, and I had the opportunity to train at a gym in Key West, and I very much enjoyed it. And I enjoy every aspect of it. I mean, there was other day during class, I did a choke from mount. My mind's blanking. Usually I don't ask for the names of moves. I just see how you set them up. Anyway, so I did a choke from mount, and it required that I scrape my elbow against the guy's face to get it real tight. And the guy, I guess he had complained later that I had done that. Like, oh, it kind of burned his face. But when someone did that to me, it was like, that was part of the experience. Like, I learned how to get that choke tight, because when he scraped my face with his elbow, I knew that was required to get that choke really tight. So I just like it all. I don't know. I just really like I like everything about it. I'm all in, I guess, so.
Well, good. This is the best sport in the world.
I'd agree with you. You know, what's interesting is that, like, for example, when I roll with someone, you know, my instructor's in his mid-40s, and the head trauma's not there. And then when I did professional wrestling, the people wouldn't be able to move like they used to, a different way than in jiu-jitsu. Obviously, when you're in your late, mid-40s, early 50s, you're not going to move the same way, but it's not because you've been beat down like in professional wrestling. And that's the one thing that I really, really, really enjoy about jiu-jitsu, is that Henzo Gracie, for example, who's in his, you know, mid-40s, he still moves okay. He moves very, very well, better than most, and he didn't take, you know, head trauma from jiu-jitsu, and so he can get out there and roll and not worry about getting hurt per se, like you would if you were a boxer or a fighter of another degree, or even if you're a pro wrestler. And I think that's one of my favorite things about it.
I do think that that one thing, if I could give one piece of advice to you and everybody else as someone who's done this for quite a while, don't get stacked. That's like my number one piece of advice that I have learned over the years. Don't get stacked. Because like anything else, you can tap. You know what I mean? Someone goes for your arm, just tap. Someone goes for your neck, just tap. Someone goes for whatever, just tap. You're not going to get hurt. But no one taps from being on their back and getting stacked. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And that is not, I'm telling you right now, if you want to have a rough life in your later years, get stacked a lot. It's all I'll say. I mean, learn how to use an open guard, get off your back. You know, the more I do, the more I understand the old school tactic of, sweep, mount, submit. That's what it should be. sweep mount submit, or if you're aggressive, pass mount submit. You know, the guard position, I mean, it's a great position. It's a great self-defense position if you end up on your back. But at the end of the day, you know, this idea of I'm on my back, I'm in the guard, I'm going to work to submit this big guy. And meanwhile, he's smashing you and he's, you know, crushing you and you're working to get this or that. All you're doing is shortening your jiu-jitsu career. Sweep the guy and destroy him from the top. Always submit from the top. Triangle from the top. Armbar from the top. Choke from the top. You'll have a longer career because the body is not designed to be stacked. And when you're on your back, you know, jiu-jitsu is a fun sport because you're laying down all the time. You know what I mean? You're laying down. You're rolling around. You know, you're building a lot of you're building a lot of strength all over your body, except in your back. You know, yeah, you're building your lats from squeezing and pulling and everything like that. But how are you strengthening your lower back in jiu-jitsu? Never, unless you happen to be flattening the guy out from the back, or unless you happen to be, putting pressure using your hips when you're in the mount. Other than that, there's no focus on strengthening the lower back. And so if you are repeatedly getting stacked and smashed, you're going to pay for it. That's all I'll say.
I would like to end the interview here. I would like you to get out your contact. And I actually have a couple more questions for you I'd like to ask you. So I would like to get in the weeds a little bit, if you wouldn't mind, if you had a few more minutes.
That's fine.
Okay, great. Well, so Brian, thank you very much for joining us this week. If people are interested in more about Brian Alvarez, where can they go to find out more?
WrestlingObserver.com has got everything. We've got some free shows up there. In fact, the best way to listen to the free shows is if you go to WrestlingObserver.com, there is a listen live link. And I think we've got 45 hours of free shows that play nonstop on the listen live link. You can go up there to the latest free radio shows, but I haven't updated that in a while. But listen live is just nonstop streaming. It's available on TuneIn Radio. And essentially, if you like what you hear, we usually do two shows every single day. So if you sign up, they're available on, you can sign up, put your information in on iTunes and have them podcasted, downloaded to your phone. Use Downcast. A lot of people use that. You can just download them off the front page. But we got the Wrestling Observer newsletter. We got Observer Archives. We got Figure Four Weekly Archives, all of the radio shows. We got like 5,000 shows in the archives dating back to 2005. So if you love the audio, sign up and you will never run out of it. And if you scroll anywhere on the front page or any of the secondary pages, you'll see that Death of WCW graphic. Click on that and buy the book. And over 100 reviews on Amazon, over a 4-star rating. That's the original. And this one is significantly better. So head up there and purchase the book. And I really appreciate it. So thanks, everybody, for listening.
And thank you for joining us. And I can personally say that I'll be purchasing a hardcover. I read the original book and greatly enjoyed it. I would tell anyone listening, if they hadn't read the first one and you have time to wait for the second one, purchase it, and you won't be disappointed. Thank you very much for joining me, Brian. And you can download this show via iTunes. And we'll be back later with a new episode of OWW Radio.